months of unhoused people to you testing them.
Right. So, you know, it's been hard to get testing, you know, if you're not a basketball player, if you're not a rich person. And so literally, we just been going out. And first of all, we did a survey of individuals to see what their symptoms are. And we identified people who needed to be tested. But then, you know, because we are the epicenter of the epidemic, and this is the most vulnerable population, I just figured that we should be testing people at random as well to sample population sizes to see how far, you know, this virus has spread already. And honestly, though, this is supposed to be the city and the county's job in doing this, in providing necessities and testing individuals that are in this vulnerable population. And I think it just speaks to the fact that that I even have to do this. You know, it shouldn't be my job to volunteer out there to make sure that homeless individuals are cared for, you know, especially in a pandemic. Well, so at the surface, it feels like a feel-good story, but it's really not.
Well, Dr. Armin Henderson, I want to ask if you can stay with us for a few more minutes. We're going to continue our conversation about your work with the unhoused and your detention. Dr. Armin Henderson, internal medicine physician, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Miami, handcuffed by the New York police, by the Miami police. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll put part two at democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO, the best in community radio.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Trump is defunding the WHO, a special report on farm workers who will be excluded from the CARES Act, and in international news, Germany is planning to ease coronavirus restrictions beginning next week. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Jail populations throughout Multnomah County have dropped, according to recent statistics, as efforts to control the spread of COVID-19 continue. Compared to the beginning of March, the adult population at the county's two prisons has gone down by over 30%, with a combined occupancy at 62% full versus 92% just last month as the novel coronavirus crisis was becoming apparent. Different factors account for the drop, including fewer arrests, early releases of sentenced inmates, and pretrials that have been sped up. Officers are giving greater numbers of citations for misdemeanor infractions, resulting in fewer arrests and less jail time, with court appearances set for future dates. Arrests are still being maintained for misdemeanor allegations relating to domestic violence or other life-threatening crimes. The district attorney's office has also been in step with COVID-19 concerns over safety, allowing offenders with less than 2 weeks left of incarceration time to be released immediately, and allowing for the release of inmates older than 65 with underlying health conditions. Similarly, Multnomah County's juvenile detention population has also diminished, with released youth being monitored through county community supervision. Though mandatory testing of all existing jail populations remains unavailable, daily screenings of inmates is the protocol, including temperature taking and checking for any COVID-19-related symptoms. Jails do have test kits on site and are testing those who have had known exposure to a confirmed coronavirus case, administrators are prepared to relocate stricken inmates to hospitals if needed. Despite the lowering of prison populations, Multnomah County Detention Center still books an estimated 30 people a day, according to officials, presenting further challenges to the effort to control and flatten COVID-19 behind bars. Two Portland nursing homes account for 13 of the 20 COVID-19 deaths in Multnomah County. 9 people have died at healthcare at Foster Creek on Southeast 136th, with 4 deaths associated with Laurelhurst Village on Southeast Stark. Statewide, 32 of Oregon's 55 deaths occurred at long-term care facilities, including 6 at the Astor House in Newburgh and 4 at the Lebanon Veterans Home. People in such facilities often have pre-existing health issues that make them more vulnerable, while the structures of such places often do not provide enough protection or space for distancing. As of yesterday, Oregon had 1,633 cases of the virus, with 381 people hospitalized and over 32,000 tested. President Trump announced yesterday that he would order the U.S. to stop funding the World Health Organization pending further review. He accused the agency of, quote, severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus, criticisms Trump himself has received regarding his handling of the pandemic. The function of the WHO is to, quote, be an international leader in public health by alerting the world to threats, fighting diseases, and developing policy and improving access to care. Worldwide coronavirus cases are now at over 2 million, with deaths over 128,000. Lawrence Gostin, a law professor at Georgetown University who advises the WHO, said Trump's action, quote, sends a toxic political signal that the United States is not interested in supporting a robust global health leadership. The U.S. is the top contributor to the WHO, providing around 1/6 of the organization's budget. The number of COVID-19 cases are set to peak this week in the United States as Republicans around the country advocate to lessen or remove social distancing measures. KBOO's Nat Moon has more on the story.
Multiple health officials, including the director of the CDC, have stated the coronavirus outbreak will reach its peak in the United States this week. The daily death toll was about 2,000 people for every day of the last week, with just over 2,400 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of confirmed U.S. deaths from coronavirus to over 26,000. The U.S. has the highest number of deaths from coronavirus, and these numbers are feared to be low as they don't include those who have died at home or who have died without getting tested for the virus. Officials warn that states shouldn't ease up on social distancing as a resurgence of the virus is highly likely if they do so. As California Governor Gavin Newsom said on Tuesday, quote, science, not politics, must be the guide. It can't be ideological. We can't get ahead of ourselves. I don't want to make a political decision that puts everyone's lives at risk. Even as data suggests the worst of the pandemic may still be ahead of us, some Republicans are pushing to reopen the economy as soon as possible. Representative Trey Hollingsworth said on Tuesday that policymakers should risk a wave of new coronavirus deaths in order to lessen the economic slowdown, saying, quote, we are going to have to look Americans in the eye and say we are making the best decisions for the most Americans possible, and the answer to that is to get Americans back to work. It is not zero evil, but it is the lesser of these two evils. GOP Representative Andy Biggs told Politico this week that lifting the lockdowns, quote, should have happened yesterday. Ending social distancing measures, as Hollingsworth and Biggs are advocating, won't magically restart the economy, according to Vice and multiple other sources, especially if returning to normal too soon triggers a second wave of positive cases and deaths. In fact, new research on the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic shows that U.S. cities that, quote, intervened earlier and more aggressively do not perform worse and, if anything, grow faster economically after the pandemic is over. Most U.S. citizens, however, seem to agree that human life is more important than economic growth. A poll published today found that just 10% of respondents think social distancing should end. 81%, including 72% of Republicans, think the public should, quote, continue to social distance for as long as is needed to curb the spread of coronavirus, even if it means continued damage to the economy. I'm Nat Moon.
Donald Trump and his political allies have excluded over a million farm workers in the U.S. from receiving any benefits under the recent CARES Act. These farm workers live and work in conditions where the spread of the virus is an immediate danger. Now, Trump's Secretary of Agriculture is trying to breathe new life into an old proposal to abandon the guaranteed wage received by hundreds of thousands of guest workers in the H-2A visa program. For more, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with journalist David Bacon about the situation of farm workers and what people can do to help these essential workers.
I wonder if you could start, David, by telling us about the situation of the 2.5 million farm workers across the United States right now during this pandemic.
Well, those 2.5 million farm workers are working producing the fruits and vegetables that are winding up in supermarkets all over the country. So that's why they're essential. And of course, they've been essential all the way along. But especially now, because people are sheltering in place and trying to survive, what farm workers do is even more important than it ever has been. But farm workers are being excluded from the benefits in the federal legislation that was passed, the CARES Act, which has those payments of $1,200 for each person, and also provides for extended unemployment. And the reason why they're being excluded is because about half of those 2.5 million people are undocumented. And so the legislation specifically excludes undocumented people. And people without social security numbers, in other words, undocumented people, can't get unemployment either, because that's a requirement. So what this really means is that, in effect, people are being forced to work because of poverty, because of people's need to survive. So even though people are being called essential, there's a certain hypocrisy in this, because people are really being treated in a very kind of what I think is a very ugly and brutal way.
I understand that a number of these workers are on a guest worker program that that Donald Trump is trying to go after right now. Are they in danger of losing their status?
Well, about 250,000 people come to the U.S. under what are called H-2A visas every year, meaning that people are recruited in primarily in Mexico to come and work on farms here, in which they are in a very, very vulnerable situation. If listeners remember the old Bracero program, this is kind of like that. Because people are only able to be here for as long as their work contract lasts, and people are living in pretty remote rural areas, and so for things like food or housing, people are very dependent on the grower that brings them here. And if people do things that offend the grower or for one reason or another get fired, like, for instance, organizing a union or going on strike, then people are immediately deported. So that people are in a very vulnerable situation to begin with. And now the administration, what it's doing is that there is in the law a certain guarantee of wages that it varies state by state. And it's not very much of a guarantee. It's just generally very slightly above whatever the state minimum wage is. But now the Trump administration is going after those guarantees and saying that really there shouldn't be any guaranteed minimum wage for these workers, which would immediately lower their wages. And by lowering their wages, it would also lower the wages of other farm workers, because what growers do is that when farm workers who are living here in the United States, who are generally immigrants themselves but are residents here, when those farm workers ask for increases in wages or better conditions, oftentimes what the response of growers is to say, well, don't ask for too much, because I can always bring in these H-2A workers and replace you.
And now the United Farm Workers are organizing, but they represent a very small number of farm workers. We just celebrated the birthday of Cesar Chavez on March 31st, and he was one of the founders of United Farm Workers. What is that union doing, and how can people support the work of Trump? trying to get farm workers a living wage and the protection that they need.
And of course, it was also just recently the birthday of Dolores Huerta, who is another co-founder of the United Farm Workers. And happy birthday to them both. So the United Farm Workers Union is, of course, one of the most important unions for farm workers, and came out of the Great Strike in California back in the 60s. But up there in Oregon, you have another union for farm workers, PICUN, the Pineros, as they're called. And then up in Washington State, there's a new union for farm workers, Familias Unidas por la Justicia. And these are all unions that right now are very active in trying to find ways of protecting farm workers from the threat of the virus, and also to try to fight against this kind of discrimination in wages and income that we've just been talking about. Among the things that the United Farm Workers are doing is it has written a letter to all growers saying that growers should take immediately steps to keep workers safe, which includes finding ways for workers to work at an appropriate physical distance of at least 6 feet, giving workers transportation to and from the fields so that people aren't packed in like sardines into cars or vans where the threat of the transmission of the virus is a lot greater. Familias Unidas up in Washington State is calling for hazard pay for farm workers because of having to work during this crisis situation. They're calling for a base wage of $25 an hour and hazard pay on top of that. One of the things that people need to do in cities like Portland and in progressive states like Oregon is to advocate for the right of workers to organize. The best protection that workers can have against the virus is a union. And the best protection that workers can have for their wages, and the best way to get the wages of farm workers up towards a living wage, is to have some bargaining power. And it's unions that give people that bargaining power. So, trying to help unions like PICUN and the United Farm Workers and the Medias Unidas, all of these things are very important.
And if people do want to get involved and support PICUN here in Oregon, their website is pcun.org. That's PICUN.org, PCUN.org. I really want to thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO to talk about the situation of the farm workers across the United States during this pandemic situation. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for We Are All in This Together with Suzanne LeGrand, talking to small business owners about how COVID-19 is impacting them. And after that, we'll hear news from the Boo. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 44. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 70. Today in history, Jean-Paul Sartre died in 1980. Sartre was known as a philosopher and a political activist, and a leading voice on existentialism and Marxism. Sartre fought to live authentically, and he, along with his partner Simone de Beauvoir, challenged cultural and social norms, fighting against conformity and personal oppression. The quote of the day is from Jean-Paul Sartre, who said, "Naturally, in the course of my life, I have made lots of mistakes, large and small, for one reason or another. But at the heart of it all, every time I made a mistake, it was because I was not radical enough." Germany is planning to take its first steps to reopen the economy on April 20th. KBOO's Nat Moon has more on the story.
Germany announced today it will begin its first steps in undoing coronavirus lockdowns in the coming weeks, but Chancellor Angela Merkel stressed that the government continues to recommend citizens wear face masks while shopping and on public transport. Businesses smaller than 800 square meters will be allowed to reopen on April 20th, as well as car dealerships and bookstores, regardless of size. Hair salons will reopen on May 4th, but employees must wear personal protective equipment at all times. Restaurants will remain closed to dine in, but will continue to offer delivery and takeout. Companies are encouraged to continue working from home wherever possible. Physical distancing rules will remain in place until at least May 3rd, and schools across the country will be allowed to open gradually starting May 4th. A ban on large public events will be upheld until August 31st, including religious gatherings, which will remain prohibited until further notice. The German government said in a document outlining its plan, quote, "The goal is to take small steps to restart public life while at the same time maintaining protective measures to prevent new chains of infection." However, refugees applying for asylum in Germany fear the government is failing to shield them from the virus, as infections in a crowded reception center have risen sharply from 7 to 251 in the last 5 days. Residents in a refugee center last week went on a hunger strike protesting the lack of disinfectants available. More than 133,000 people have tested positive for the virus in Germany, behind only the U.S., Spain, and Italy in terms of total reported infections nationwide. Germany, however, has managed to keep a lower death toll with only 3,600 known deaths. I'm Nat Moon.
The state of Mexico has launched a portal with COVID-19 data that shows the coronavirus is disproportionately impacting Native Americans. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal economies are hurting right now due to COVID-19. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr has more.
Take the Eastern Shoshone Tribe. Their casino is closed and their oil and gas revenues have taken a nosedive. Business Councilwoman Karen Snyder says those two enterprises fund the tribe's government and public services.
We just don't know what this is going to do to the per cap moving forward. We don't know what it's going to do to the internal infrastructure. We are cutting hours for our tribal government officials.
Joseph Kalt with Harvard's Project on American Indian Economic Development says they're not alone. According to a study by the group, over a million jobs and $12 billion in revenue is at stake if tribal enterprises don't survive the pandemic.
We run a risk, essentially, of reversing what's been about 30 years of slow but at least steady progress in economic development, jobs creation, and the overall standard of living.
Tribes have until Friday to apply for their slice of the $8 billion set aside for them in the federal stimulus bill. But it's not yet clear how that money will be divided up, and tribal casinos aren't eligible for loans through the Paycheck Protection Program. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
The state of New Mexico has launched a portal with COVID-19 data showing the coronavirus is disproportionately impacting tribes. The statewide race ethnicity breakdown shows the Native American Alaska Native population in New Mexico makes up 36.68% of positive COVID-19 cases. According to a press release from New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's office, the state has conducted extensive testing in Native communities where clusters of illness have been identified, which at least in part explains the disproportionate numbers. Last week, the state reported clusters in two small tight-knit Pueblo communities north of Albuquerque, San Felipe, and Zia. The Pueblo of Zuni near Gallup is also seeing increases in positive tests. And the Navajo Nation, which has land in the state, is being hit hard. Lujan Grisham has publicly shared her concerns about tribal communities and COVID-19. The New Mexico Indian Affairs Department last week issued a tribal response plan. Indian Affairs is also working on food distribution, broadband, and other supplies outreach. Tribal leaders and directors of national Native organizations have voiced concerns about the devastating impacts COVID-19 could have on tribes, pointing to long-standing issues in Indian country, including chronic underfunding of the Indian Health Service and many infrastructure and housing needs. Meanwhile, the number of positive COVID-19 tests continue to increase daily on the Navajo Nation. Tuesday's reported numbers were 838, which includes cases in New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. and 33 deaths related to the coronavirus. Navajo leaders are urging residents to stay home and follow orders issued by the tribe. They're working to extend weekend curfews for the next few weeks after leaders say a 57-hour curfew over Easter was successful. The top two leaders are a week into self-isolation after having close contact with a first responder who tested positive for COVID-19. Seduction Point in Haines, Alaska will go by its Tlingit name, Ajiklatu, meaning point within a point. The Chilkoot Indian Association applied to change the name last year. Local elders and historians say the name Seduction Point misrepresents the 18th century rape of a Tlingit woman by British sailors. The Alaska Historical Commission approved the proposal last year. The Board of Geographical Names met virtually in April to officially accept the change. The change is expected to be updated in the official Geographic Names database in the coming days, and federal maps and charts will be updated in the next revision cycle. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren endorsed Joe Biden for president today, giving Biden a trifecta of endorsements following President Barack Obama yesterday and Senator Bernie Sanders on Monday. Warren, who quit the race last month, is the last of Biden's major opponents for the nomination to endorse him. Warren wrote today, quote, "Biden knows that a government run with integrity, competence, and heart will save lives and save livelihoods." She continued, quote, "We can't afford to let Donald Trump continue to endanger the lives and livelihoods of every American." Biden has vowed to choose a woman as his vice presidential candidate. While two women, Sarah Palin and Geraldine Ferraro, have run for vice president, no woman has yet held that office. Barack Obama endorsed presidential hopeful Joe Biden yesterday. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Of course, Democrats may not always agree on every detail of the best way to bring about each and every one of these changes. But we do agree that they're needed. And that only happens if we win this election.
Former President Barack Obama endorsed his former Vice President Joe Biden yesterday, urging various wings of the Democratic Party to come together. He accused the current Republican Party of being more interested in power than progress and called for bold change.
I could not be prouder of the incredible progress that we made together during my presidency. But if I were running today, I wouldn't run the same race or have the same platform as I did in 2008. The world is different. There's too much unfinished business for us to just look backwards. We have to look to the future.
The Trump campaign quickly dismissed Obama's foray into the race, saying he had no other choice. But Mississippi State Representative John Hines, a Democrat, says it was no surprise.
For the first time in the last few years, people are excited. Joe Biden has found a way to capitalize on the same type of energy that Barack Obama had.
George Washington University professor Todd Bent says Obama's backing legitimizes Biden's claims.
Obama is very, very popular, not just with Democrats, but with independents as well. And there's nothing better than to have the president actually endorse him or to actually go on campaign tour with him or to make commercials so that it rings true. And it's not just Biden saying it over and over again.
It's commonplace for former presidents to stump for their party's nominee. But George W. Bush says he left his presidential ballot blank in 2016. His father, H.W. Bush, voted for Clinton. Kyle Condick from University of Virginia's Center for Politics says the lack of presidential endorsements helped Trump demonstrate his outsider status.
I think Obama is a more beloved figure amongst Democrats than, say, George W. Bush is amongst Republicans. And I think that that's sort of reflected in, you know, Biden trumpeting the endorsement of Obama, where I don't think someone like Donald Trump would even seek George W. Bush's endorsement.
Obama also critiqued President Trump's response to the pandemic. Hours later, the president announced a halt to funding for the World Health Organization, pending his administration's review of what he calls WHO, quote, mismanagement and cover-up of the new coronavirus, unquote. Though others have objected to the WHO's praise for China's overall response, too, Trump praised China's efforts himself in a tweet in January. The Democratic National Committee's response, the president is putting, quote, global health at further risk to deflect blame from his own failures, unquote. Meanwhile, if Congress approves the Trump administration Census Bureau's request for a four-month delay, it would drastically shorten the time to redraw all the country's districts for elections over the next 10 years, thus ignoring the past 10 years of demographic change. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael doesn't want to get back to normal.
Whenever our country reopens, let's not aim just for normal. Keep reopening what's been shut down even longer. Let's freeze student and medical debt. There's thousands of jail cells and several borders that need opening. Let's see the tax records of Trump and the billionaires. Open all those sealed mechanisms of financial markets, defense contracts, and who owns what. Let's open the voting process. Open all the windows and doors in the White House and Senate and give them a strong airing out, a purge and cleanse. We each have little boxes and closets inside of us that also need the disinfectants of sunshine and compassion. We all have plans, desires, and talents we've kept in forgotten places. Open up! They say the country won't be the same once the virus is quelled, and many think that means worse, but it could mean better. Let's have a positive pandemic of openness, change, and true populist democracy. No sociopathic, paranoid narcissist can tell us what to do or when. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The IRS launched a second online tool Wednesday to help people get their stimulus money as the number of unemployed Americans continues to grow. For those who don't file taxes online or do not have direct deposit information established with the government, the Get My Payment portal is designed to assist in a prompt delivery of federal aid. Additionally, the online system will allow tracking the status of payments. To set up direct deposit through the portal, you will need to provide current tax information and banking account specifics. Get My Payment is the follow-up to a different IRS-based web tool that was launched last week in efforts to obtain information from people who didn't file tax returns in 2018 or 2019. Social Security recipients will be receiving payments automatically, even if they didn't file a recent tax return. Over 80 million Americans have already received stimulus money, but government officials say it could take up to 5 months or longer for people to receive paper checks through the mail. The program is part of the massive federal coronavirus response legislation enacted in March, with payments up to $1,200 for individuals, $2,400 for couples, and an extra $500 for qualifying dependents under the age of 17. Further information on your eligibility and status of stimulus aid can be found on the IRS website. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at our new number, 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Jeffrey Wade, and Janka Soderberg. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke and Antonio Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for We Are All in This Together with Suzanne LeGrand.
Suzanne LeGrand, and today on We Are All in This Together, I am speaking with Ken Pico, who is a poet and the owner of the Rocking Frog Cafe. To just give us a little bit of background, you could talk about what it's like to be a small business owner on a good day.
Being a small business is a crazy thing to do in the first place, but it's really rewarding also, and just in terms of, you know, before the pandemic, I had taken over, acquired this coffee shop, Rocking Frog, in 2017. I quickly realized that just running business wasn't very fulfilling for me. It might be for some other people, but there had to be something more that we could do for the community, the city, you know, specifically artists. I wanted to provide a space for musicians and poets and artists to have a safe space to perform and, you know, be able to compensate them for that to the best of our abilities. We're not a large venue, but we still, you know, over the last year, right, exactly a year, actually, March of last year to March of this year, we built a program for weekly events. So we had a poetry night that was received with great success. It was supported by a couple of the other poetry events in town, and poetry in particular, the Portland Poetry Slam and Slamlandia. And the man I worked with, Igor, he was involved in that community and was able to get some support for it. So every Saturday night we threw an open mic and a sort of a spoken word style poetry night. And that was, you know, that was great. And we went on to do music on Sundays. We had a community art night on Mondays where people could come and work on their own projects or team projects. And there was always like a class being taught. So we had like a woodworking and a glass blowing and stained glass night. And it was all kinds of fun. And we even started doing a movie night on Wednesday. So these are the kinds of things that I really, you know, made it worthwhile for me as a business owner in a town like Portland specifically, that I've always celebrated the arts, to be giving back in some way, and to also like stimulate my own creative process, and be a part of that community. So we actually, you know, that stuff was really picking off, and we have a community that supports us, and that was participating regularly in these stuff.
I have heard that for many small business owners, and particularly in food service, you run on a very small profit margin. And
absolutely.
If you could talk a little bit about that and what has happened since the pandemic hit.
Well, unfortunately, you know, for a lot of these places, these kind of old school Portland brick and mortar places, you know, dine-in seating is kind of our charm and our draw. A lot of, you know, specifically, for instance, we make, you know, fresh donuts and those things, that product in particular is best served hot and best served in this, you know, charming little coffee shop with these books all around you, and, you know, it had its own draw. And you know, once people were not allowed to be in here, and also just, you know, being conscious of social distancing, it's a tough answer, because on the one hand, you know, this is great that we're being proactive about these things. On the other hand, it kind of left these small businesses like high and dry, just in terms of not having not having a support plan from the city or the federal government in place in a timely fashion to mitigate the economic, you know, catastrophe that happened. Essentially, you know, my business and other businesses, we lost, you know, 90% of our demand for, and like you said, you know, a lot of these places operate on razor thin margins. To lose that revenue stream, you know, puts us in a tough bind, because we're having to lay off employees. You know, there's tens of thousands of people out of work. There's overhead costs that are just being deferred instead of forgiven. Luckily, some of these small places, they don't have, you know, a ton of debt. So if I go, you know, work for a job for a few months, I might have some cash to put back into it. But, you know, it varies. You know, it's like some places are, you know, Powell's has a few months of savings and that's it. And then they're threatening to, you know, they're not going to be able to open again.
Yeah.
So it is really important, because I've been to a couple of places. You know, just yesterday I went to my favorite sandwich shop in Hawthorne, and it's like Devil's Dill, and they have a bar, and it's just the owners there now, and they were just as perplexed, honestly, if this was like a video interview with different businesses. It would just be so visible, the distress that everybody has, because, you know, I'm talking to these guys and they're saying there's no help, there's no information, and all they're doing is offering us more debt. I mean, I'm seeing those posts online too, so from other business owners, and so it's, you know, it's tricky because we don't know what's going to happen.
Is there anything that people in the community can do to help support you through this period?
So, you know, besides the fact that a lot of us are, you know, doing the best that we can to offer, you know, takeout and delivery, we also, you know, I also understand that a lot of people have lost their jobs. It's really difficult to expect, you know, the revenue to stay the same, even if we were, you know, even if our takeout and delivery was already like a solid option that, you know, we hadn't really invested a lot of time or effort into that. So, I mean, there is, you know, there lots of businesses are still offering their menus to go, but it's not enough. And, you know, other ideas that have been floated around and people have adapted to this is, you know, buying gift cards to the businesses that you love. You know, if you go there frequently, you're going to want to go back. Once everything starts to clear up, you know, you can always call that business. You can always load up, you know, say, hey, I want to buy a gift certificate or, you know, make a roving tab for under my name, you know, put up $50 or $100 or whatever you can do. Those things really help the small businesses like get through this time by giving a little bit of cash infusion so that they can, you know, cover those payroll costs that are abruptly forced on them, and also their line of credit essentially for buying supplies to stay open. Those things are really helpful. Other than that, you know, I'm not sure how this looks right now, but any way that people can, you know, contact their local representatives and say, hey, these businesses need economic assistance. What's currently being offered for you know, and that's from the city or the state, you know, but what's currently being offered right now is really just more debt. You know, the Small Business Administration opened up its disaster loans to affected areas, including Oregon. And apparently that, you know, that process is right now, the systems are crashing, it's hard to get a hold of people. But even if we, you know, did go that route, a lot of businesses are really anxious to take on more loans, considering that they're already operating on those razor thin margins. So, you know, I don't think anybody expects to get a big check from the government for a month of revenue that they lost, but, you know, some sort of representation is crucial for these places to have some sort of support from the government when it comes down to it. Basically, a lot of these small places need help with covering the cost of the workers that were laid off. They've got payroll costs to cover. You know, those things are like upfront direct economic assistance from the government would be helpful. We don't expect to make the profits that we lost, but we do request that there's help covering our upfront costs. You know, what a lot of people are concerned about is that, you know, in 3 months or 2 months or even longer, when the things start coming back online, a lot of the utility costs and rent is going to just be deferred. You know, the city doesn't have the ability to stop rent from being collected. There's going to be a lot of landlords and ladies or small business owners themselves. So it's not their fault for wanting to collect rent. But if there's no support for them and their mortgages, there's no support for their tenants who end up having, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars of active payments due. And on top of that, you add more debt more through disaster loans. It's a lot of able to, you know, do more than just try to claw their way back out of this. My prediction is that you are going to see a lot of people shutter their doors permanently, unfortunately, if there's not, you know, some sort of direct economic assistance to these small businesses, especially Oregon, which is proud of that aspect of their economy. I think that they should really understand how urgent this is.
I have been talking today to Ken Pico, who is a poet and a owner of the Rocking Frog Cafe in Portland, Oregon, in Southeast Belmont neighborhood. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is We Are All In This Together for KBOO Community Radio News, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on KBOO Community Radio Station, your community radio. I am Jenny Yokoyama, one of your interim station co-managers, and I am joined here via Zoom.
Yes.
With my other fellow interim station co-manager, Celeste Carey. Celeste, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. We're all in isolation, looking at windows, life, doorway life, you know, TV